All right. Thank you, everyone, so much for joining. First off, huge thank you to Pilot for hosting us tonight. And shout-outs in particular to Pilot's Senior Manager of Events and Programs, Lauren Parker, over here.
Yay, Lauren!
Thank you also to the Pilot team, and then to our team as well, Sky, Andrew, Michelle, and Kay. They are all somewhere. Thank you guys so much. All right, so tonight is the sixth event in our series, Thursday Nights in AI. If you enjoy the event tonight, which I think you will, please come join us again. Next week we have Replit CEO Amjad Massad joining. Then we have Adam D'Angelo of Quora, and just a whole list of fantastic events. For Adam D'Angelo, we will be back here at Pilot, so we'll see you all soon. As context, our intent with this series is to provide folks direct contact with founders, researchers, and policymakers in AI, like Wasim. There is endless content to read online, and some of it is very good, like Wasim's Substack. But we really believe in bringing people together in person. Like, it is just very nice to look out and see people close to us and get to meet new people. And so we want to facilitate that as much as we can. This series is co-hosted by Outset Capital and Generally Intelligent. Outset Capital is the fund I run with Josh and our third partner, Ken June, who's not here tonight. We're backed by the founders of Dropbox, Quora, and Replit. And we invest in companies at the very earliest stages and actually have some portfolio founders here tonight. So if you are building, please let us know. We invest in pre-seed and seed companies. I'm full-time running the fund, and then Josh is also building Generally Intelligent, which is a new AI research company working to develop general-purpose AI agents that can safely be deployed in the real world. They are actively hiring, have some very exciting things happening, which hopefully we'll get into a little bit today. So find Josh afterwards if you're interested. Of course, finally, thank you to Wasim for joining us tonight. It is wonderful to have Wasim. Wasim is the CEO and co-founder of Pilot, which is where we are today, which specializes in bookkeeping, tax, and CFO services for high-growth tech companies. We are Pilot users. I'm guessing some folks in the crowd are Pilot users already.
I would say not just users, but promoters.
Promoters.
I love Pilot because I haven't looked at Pilot in years. And that's so happy. I'm delighted to hear that.
This is not Wasim's first rodeo. Wasim is a three-time entrepreneur with two successful exits previously. His first company, Ksplace, was acquired by Oracle in 2011. And his second company, Zulip, was acquired by Dropbox in 2014. And interestingly, all three companies are founded by the same three founders, you, Jeff, and Jessica, I believe. There's an expression, I don't know if you guys have heard it, once you're lucky, twice you're good. Wasim is thrice good. Wasim is truly like a serial founder who thinks very much about how to build companies and writes about it and talks about it. So we're just really excited to hear basically anything you have to say on the topic of building companies, but especially in AI. So very excited for tonight.
Well, thanks for having me and thank you all for coming.
All right, so how this will go is we'll do about 20, 25 minutes of chatting, and then we will open it up to the crowd for your questions. There are a few QR codes around you, and hopefully someone walked around and showed you them. So please, as you're listening and think of questions, submit questions, and then I will go through and have people ask those questions from the QR code, which is an Airtable form, and you'll get to ask questions of Wasim yourself. Okay, all right, let's get started. Okay. Many people here know what Pilot is. Obviously, we do. But let's start with a basic question. What is Pilot, and how is Pilot incorporating AI?
Sure. So what is Pilot? Pilot, essentially, is your accountant. In other words, we focus on bookkeeping, tax prep, and CFO services, principally focused on high-growth technology startups. And so when you work with us, you're paired with our world-class accounting team. There are full-time employees of ours that sit here in our office or in our office in Nashville. And every month, we get you what you need to run the financial back office for you. And the way that we're using AI and the way that we're using technology and the way that we're different than every other accounting firm, the way we're a tech company, is in addition to employing a world-class team of accountants and fractional CFOs and all that good stuff, we have a team of software engineers. And the mandate of the engineering team is to build software that we use principally internally to do the work more accurately, more reliably, more scalably. And a consequence of doing that is that we can serve lots and lots of companies. So today we serve about 2,000 startups. It makes us the largest startup-focused accounting provider in the US. And that scale directly translates into benefits for our actual customers, meaning like we've seen the movie before, we know more about the world, we have more data, we can use that to help you run the company kind of more successfully and more efficiently. And your question specifically was like, okay, well, how do we use AI? And the core thesis of the business essentially is, if you look at the work that the accountant does, there's a huge chunk of this work that really ought to be done by the computer. It should not be done by the human. And yet at every accounting firm in the world, the work is done in the same way that it was done basically in 1980, which is there's a person sitting in front of QuickBooks and they like type a bunch of stuff in. And our perspective is like, look, there have been all of these advances in the capabilities that exist. All this stuff is now in the cloud. Like, surely we can get the computer to do a lot of this heavy lifting. And some of this stuff is like techniques I wouldn't describe as AI techniques. It's just like very classical software engineering stuff. Some is just like, I don't know, we might have called it machine learning 5 or 7 years ago, like when we were starting this company. And some of it is like, cool, ChatGPT is a thing, large language models are a thing, like vector databases are a thing. Like, how do we plug those in to let us do the work better? And the specific thing we do is we take a look at what are the human accountants on the team doing? What are sources of error? What are sources of inaccuracy? What are sources of things that prevent us from scaling? And we ask, well, can we get the computer to do some of these steps?
One question, are you worried that focusing on accounting kind of now, when there's so many new capabilities coming online, and you know, you mentioned ChatGPT, and there's Codex, and there's all these generative AI, there's just so much new technology, are you worried that you're sort of missing the boat, you know, in the singularity? Like, maybe you're missing this much larger opportunity that's out there by focusing on accounting. Like, what makes you so passionate about accounting?
It's interesting because the fact that it is boring is what appeals to me about it. And that sounds a little like, you know, counterintuitive, but the way that we arrived at this problem was that this was a very big and very visceral pain for us in our previous companies, which is the first company that we did, my co-founders and I, we were all at MIT undergrad. We were like in the computer club at MIT. It was like peak nerd. And we had this technology one of my co-founders had developed that allowed us to update running Linux systems without rebooting. We had some technology that could like go in and modify the Linux kernel while it was chugging along. And we're like, this is cool. Like, we think other people should use this. Like, let's do a startup. And we just didn't know anything about anything. We had no idea how to run a business. And I think the realization that hits you when you start your first company is like, well, you started it for a particular reason. You had some capability you wanted to bring into the world. And yeah, of course you spent time on that, but there's all this other stuff you have to contend with. There's accounting and legal and HR and IT and finance and insurance and blah, 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 blah. And our perspective is, accounting is kind of just the beginning for Pilot as we think about the 20-year journey. The perspective is, listen, the high leverage stuff for every founder or business owner to be doing is the specific reason they started the company. It's to build that product or service. And in many ways, if we can be the like sink for that like boring but actually really important work and give you back the time to actually focus on making your company successful, in that way we're an accelerant of all the other stuff. And again, it's like a little picks and shovelsy. It's like, well, what we're doing is we're making you more successful and hopefully you're the ones building AGI. I think that's the way we contribute to it. And there's a lot of, like, the thing that makes it interesting for me is there's a lot of pain here. And that has always been kind of a North Star for us, which is like, how do we find and eliminate pain in various ways?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I'm curious, you know, obviously you're doing a ton in AI. I'm sure you're building an AI team, expanding an existing AI team. For folks that are like, oh, I could join Anthropic or OpenAI or work on accounting, how do you convince them? What if they're coming in not saying, I love boring stuff, but they're like, I want to work on cool stuff. How do you convince them that this is cool stuff?
Sure. It's a good question. And I think a lot about like, so I was at Dropbox before this. Dropbox had acquired our second company, and then we were at Dropbox for about 2 years, my co-founders and I. And if you think about Dropbox, like, it's like file sync. That sounds like pretty commodity. That sounds pretty boring. Like, but there was a time, and its best days are probably behind it, unfortunately, but there was a time when it was like the it company in Silicon Valley. And like, why is that? Well, one, I think there are like hard and interesting technology problems. And two is that there was just like a really, really, really amazing team. There was just this like strong density of smart, talented people like who cared deeply and like were working hard on this problem. And I think like one of the things that Pilot has going for it as a place to work is the talent density. And my experience has been that, like, yes, the mission of course matters, and it always matters, and anyone tells you that it doesn't is probably not being entirely truthful. But what matters more than people think is, like, do you enjoy working with your coworkers? Like, do you have autonomy? Do you have agency? Do you have impact? And that's actually like pretty domain independent.
That makes sense. You mentioned generative AI. I know you put out Pilot GPT. Excellent name, by the way.
You're very original.
How is that changing your product? Like, obviously, you have been working in AI since Pilot's inception. That was part of the thesis of the company. I think Jeff, your co-founder and COO, was actually at OpenAI leading operations before you decided that you weren't done yet and you had to do it again for a third company together. So I'm just curious, how has your business changed with the rise of LLMs?
Sure. So I think there broadly are like two or three potential buckets of applications for LLMs at Pilot. As you'll see when I kind of break this down, we're really quite laser focused on the first, which is category number one of things you might point an LLM at are, what are pieces of the process that our team does internally today associated with closing the books or producing the financial statements or doing the taxes or whatever? What are pieces of the process that are today done by a human? And done by a human always means done slowly and inaccurately, like approximately.
Ouch.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, like, if you look at sort of where the mistakes get made, and this is not a knock on the team is truly world class, but like when you have the person touch the thing, like that is usually where the error is introduced. So big bucket of work number one is like, what is being done by a human today that could be done by the computer? And there's a bunch of like things that seem quite tactical, but are like, you have an invoice and you want to know what its service period was. GPT is really good at like pulling that out. Or you have some transactions and you're trying to figure out how to categorize them. Like, GPT is very good at identifying.
But you were using AI systems for categorizing stuff before. So I'm just curious, like, what has changed?
Yes, great question. So what's interesting about this is like the workload today that is being done by the human is, let's call it, and these numbers are a little bit made up, let's call it the like hardest 20% of the work. In other words, it's the stuff that the classical techniques couldn't do or don't do today. And the nice thing at Pilot about what we do is like, anytime the computer doesn't know what to do, the computer can kind of just like raise its hand and be like, I don't know, like you, the account manager who works on this account, can you just do this piece? And that's actually one way that we're like quite different than a self-driving car, which is the self-driving car cannot really be like, I don't know what to do, like you
your
drive.
Turn.
Yes, like that's fine in your Tesla, I guess. That's not fine in a fully autonomous self-driving car. But we have that property, we can always fall back to the human. So there are a bunch of tasks that today fall back to the human. And those are tasks that for whatever reason, the existing stuff we built isn't capable of doing. And we found that on that hardest of workloads, you actually just get a huge lift by like pointing the LLMs at it. And it's like it's just like a long tail of weird stuff. Because if it were the simple things, your existing techniques would have already gotten it. Mm-hmm. But big area of investment number one for us is, how do we take these things that are today done by people at Pilot and how do we have the computer do them using LLMs, using whatever? Area of investment number two, where we've spent almost no time, is like generative AI powered product features.
Like customer facing?
Yeah, like customer facing. Like everything I've described is basically invisible to the customer, meaning it's not obvious. And if we're doing our jobs well, you shouldn't really care how it's done. It shouldn't even be clear to you how it's done. It should just be clear that it's correct. Investment number two could be like, well, could I have like a CFO chatbot that like on Saturday at 11 p.m. I can go and be like, tell me about what's happening in my books. And it could be like, boop, 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 you're spending too much or whatever. You know, like that, presumably at some point we will build that, but actually we've spent almost no time there. And the reason we spent almost no time there is I'm not really convinced that it's what our users really want. Meaning it's a cool marketing demo. Like, cool, maybe you could get it on Hacker News or something, or Product Hunter or whatever.
It'd do great on Twitter.
Yeah, like Twitter, you get some retweets on it, whatever. But I don't think anyone is like, you know, I really want to be able to chat with my financial statements. Mm. Like, I just don't think that that's really a pain that our customers
have.
Well,
let's ask, who here wants to chat?
Raise your hand if you want to chat with your financial statements. That guy. Okay.
It's like, but I'm the team lead for option two that is getting no investment.
Exactly. I mean, going back to the theme of like being boring, we have intentionally devoted our energy to the things that improve quality, improve accuracy, improve speed, improve gross margin, which ultimately are in service of delivering a better experience to the customer. And we have explicitly not invested in things that are cool, but like don't seem to add real business value for our customers.
Are you worried that over time, the moat that you've created by making all these specialized tools for people will kind of erode as we have more capable AI systems that maybe you can just point ChatGPT at your receipts in the future and, oh, ta-da, it did all the bookkeeping for me, hooray.
Yeah, it's a good question, which is like the capabilities of these tools are obviously increasing and are increasing at a pretty dramatic rate. Our perspective is, and you know, am I just burying my head in the sand on this? I don't know. You'll have to keep me honest. Our perspective is, if such a capability were to emerge, and I think it is a question really of when, not of if, who is best positioned to take advantage of it? And if the capability is the result of one of these foundational models that are publicly available, well, presumably we get it at the same time that everyone else gets it. And so I guess the question would be, is there something structural about what we do that causes us not to take advantage of it for some reason? And I think the answer there is no.
Or if the capabilities are internal to one of these large language model providers like Anthropic or OpenAI or Google, where they have access to capabilities that are not available in the open source models.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, even in that case, like, sure, we use all of those providers. Mm-hmm. I think the question then is, well, could someone else develop it using their proprietary data set or techniques or whatever? And of course, there's certainly a possibility. I think we have one of the advantages of seeing a lot of the data just by virtue of what we do with our customers. So I think we're also pretty good there too. Now, again, I don't think it's an unassailable fortress or whatever, but this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, in general, as you think about all this new stuff, does it structurally benefit the upstart, or does it structurally benefit the incumbent? And I think this is one of these weird cases where the benefit mostly does accrue to the incumbent, meaning I think everyone has access to the same stuff. If you could do it in a weekend using the ChatGPT API, someone at Google or Facebook or Intuit or whatever, like presumably also could. And so I'm curious to see how the sort of the balance affects startups versus incumbents in terms of how this stuff gets adopted.
I guess taking a step back from Pilot, this is, you know, something you're thinking about. It's also something a lot of other companies are thinking about. There's kind of this like middle zone of companies that I've been thinking about. Pilot, others like Cresta, Jasper, where they've been building an AI for a long time and they've built up a lot of stuff. And now there is a question because LLMs are so accessible now of like, can their business hold up, maintain their moat? So we kind of talked about Pilot. I'm just curious, and you don't need to name names if you don't want to, but I'm just curious, for those companies, do you think they can kind of maintain their edge? They do have the customer relationships for now, but like, they're startups themselves. It hasn't been that long. It's not impossible to build those customer relationships. I'm curious how you see that.
So there was a tweet about this like the other day, where Paul Graham was like, anyone who calls something a GPT wrapper is an idiot or whatever.
I also saw this.
And then I was like, oh God, I've been using that term. So I might have to revise my answer here. Now, my perspective is like, you have to think about what the moat your company has is. And if the moat is simply, you know, you were using GPT-3 or you had something that could produce a capability that is similar to what you could get with GPT-4 or whatever. Like if that is the only aspect of the moat, you kind of have a pretty big problem because now like your secret sauce is available to everyone. Now, if you have some structural advantage, if you have like advantages on distribution or brand or whatever, like yes, those things will help you. So it is not enough for someone else to have your exact same technology to kill you. Like in other words, if a new company started today that had all of the code we'd written at Pilot, I wouldn't be happy about it. I'd be concerned about it, certainly. But there are also like, you know, there are efforts we have made in the community and the ecosystem with our partner. Like there's a bunch of brand work that we've basically done that is not trivial to reproduce.
Okay, so you're saying the moat is your brand work?
Well, I think the moat is the customer relationship and like what the customer thinks about you. And how powerful that is probably is a function of like how good is the customer experience and maybe how sticky is it. Like the thing that would make you happiest is there's strong network effects. Like once you use the thing, like you can't switch something like, you know, Threads or whatever is the Twitter clone, but I don't know. So you like network effects obviously are like a very classic example of a moat. So if you like use some LLMs and you'll set some network effects, I feel like you're pretty good.
Beautiful.
Then golden. You're great.
You'd invest immediately.
Right, totally. Done. Let's write that check. You know, if your sole differentiation was like, okay, we had the ability to generate text that satisfied certain properties, or, you know, we could generate funny images or whatever, and now anyone can do that, I would definitely be more nervous.
Okay, so I'm hearing like stickiness is a big thing to think about as a potential moat. I think you also, relationships and just like having a, especially when you're doing something I'm sure as fundamental as accounting, like it's probably a little bit more important that people really have trust in their accounting
sure.
than maybe like for a Jasper and writing blog posts. And then I think you kind of mentioned data earlier, right? And that's again, part of Pilot's secret sauce. It's like all of this data, which just makes their systems better and better over time.
Yeah.
Those are kind of the aspects that I'm hearing of moat.
I do. I think so. And then I think your customer is using your product or service for some reason. They have some itch they're trying to get scratched. If the itch can be more easily scratched elsewhere, yeah, I think that's a big problem for you. This is an example that was before all of your times probably, but you know, it's like Netscape versus IE. Like Microsoft just like put IE in the operating system and like, yeah, you're going to use it. It's right there. And it didn't matter if the other browser was better or whatever. It was like, cool, the convenient thing that's going to scratch your itch is just right there. You're going to use it. And so if I was going to app XYZ to make use of some capability and then suddenly become a feature of Notion or a feature of Gmail or a feature of whatever, like, am I still really going to go and like use that thing? Probably not. I'll probably just do the thing that's very convenient to me. And I think that's why these incumbents pose such a threat to upstarts in the space, which is, well, if they can power the thing the same way you are powering the thing and they can make it even easier for you to get, that's pretty scary.
Got it. I want to go back a little bit. You said something that was interesting. You said I was
just one thing. That's only one thing that was interesting.
The one thing that has caught my attention thus far. You said I was pushing of like, okay, but what are you using generative AI for now that you were not using it for before? Like what is new or what can I do better? And you said there's like this long tail of weird stuff. I'm actually very curious what's in that long tail. Obviously, you are in the weeds trying to figure out when to use this new capability. Like, have you noticed any patterns? Like, when does this work well in your experience? And when does this, i.e. generative AI, not work so well?
Well, the place that doesn't work so well is math.
And not, I think that's not good at math.
That's
yeah.
a known limitation.
And it got worse at math, I think, right?
That's like, what they say. Yeah. We haven't tried to use it for math, so I don't really know. There are places where the straightforward thing to do is just to do the computation. Like a silly example of this is if you Google like, you know, 143 plus 2,472, there probably is a website that in fact like has those two numbers and has the answer, but it just shows you the little box with the calculator. Sometimes it's just better to just do the calculation. So there are places where the answer is very straightforward and you just want the structured programmatic thing. And especially in accounting, financial statements you produce, they're all related to each other mathematically. Like you want all those constraints to be maintained.
Like, don't guess what goes into EBITDA.
Right.
Like.
Don't guess at what my bank balance is. Just tell me what it really was, not what the first seven tokens suggested that the eighth token might be. So when it's super straightforward, you don't want to use the LLM. And we don't because we built all this stuff to do it pre-LLM. The places that it's really good are the places that have some ambiguity, which is like interpreting any human input is a classic example. Or like trying to discern what things are similar. And here's what I mean by that. One of the boring but important steps in producing your financial statements is understanding where you spent your money and categorizing it according to the categories that appear on your income statement. And so we might see a transaction from Lyft. And this is not a good example because obviously we know where Lyft goes, but you might see a transaction from a given vendor that we've never seen before. And you're like, cool, where should I put that? Well, there isn't really a structured way of doing that because we haven't ever seen that particular vendor before. But what you can do is like you can search the internet and find out more about this particular vendor. And then you can ask the LLM, what vendors like this have I previously seen and where did those go? In my contrived Lyft example, well, we saw a transaction at Uber. You know, Uber went into ground transportation, therefore Lyft should also go into ground transportation. And like the act of doing that comparison is not like where the AI comes in. Where the AI comes in is actually in the semantic, like the word Uber is near the word Lyft, or really I should say the paragraph that describes this transaction is semantically close to the paragraph that describes this other transaction in this complicated multi-dimensional space. Those are places where it's like, wow, that's good. And then, as I said, the human is the source of the error. It is basically as good or better than the human. Because obviously we have lots of data from when the human categorized these transactions. And like one of the things we do in playing around with this stuff is we say, well, let's test it. Like, let's see how it did relative to the human and like, let's grade it. And then you're like, well, what did it get wrong? And you go and you look and you're like, well, actually, no, it was kind of right. And the person was kind of wrong. Or like, well, it's kind of ambiguous. You're sort of both right. You know, that's sometimes this stuff is not perfectly black and white. Yeah. But those are places where it's just like, wow, it's very good. And trying to do that pre-LLMs would have been extremely challenging.
Contrarian opinion that you hold when it comes to AI?
It's a good question because usually I'm like a...
More than one good two, as many as you want.
Usually I'm like a bit of a naysayer and kind of a downer. I'm definitely an optimist, but I'm quite grumpy about new stuff usually.
You're a grumpy optimist.
I'm a grumpy optimist, that's right. Like I was very, and this is on trend now, so it's not cool if I say it. I was very anti-crypto, like when crypto was big. But I'm like actually kind of an AI true believer in the sense that obviously, this will change a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know that like the robots are going to take over anytime soon or whatever. I'm not that worried about AGI enslaving humanity case. I think there are going to be a lot of interesting and boring business applications that are dramatically accelerated by AI. I think there's going to be some scary stuff.
Ooh, like what?
Like misinformation and, I don't know, falling in love with your AI robot or whatever. Like, it's not obvious to me that like, there will be certain aspects of living in, you know, 2040, whatever, where you probably would have been happier in 2020, whatever. But yeah, I don't know.
Going off script, but I know you recently had a kid, right? Your first kid. Congratulations.
Yes, thanks.
Your kid is going to grow up in like an AI first world.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I mean, between AI and climate change, he'll be fine. But like, it's going to be pretty bleak out there. Yeah, I have some concerns for sure.
Yeah. I'm curious, like education, learning, you know, his future, his or her actually future career.
Well, I think a lot of the stuff will get super, super good. Like, yeah, you'll get the amazing tutorial, like one-on-one tutoring experience from the AI. Like that stuff is basically available now or seems to be quite on the horizon. So obviously I think there will be lots of quite exciting stuff that is a consequence of that.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to ask one last question, and then please submit your questions, because then we'll open it up to Q&A. So last question is, you know, as I alluded to, not your first rodeo. You're like, everyone uses the term serial entrepreneur, so it doesn't have, like, much weight, but, like, serial successful entrepreneur who's, like, had real outcomes, built teams, like, done a lot of incredible things. You're also, in some ways, on the front lines of a lot of this uncertainty and craziness, right? So you're incorporating AI into your own product. You're an AI believer. You were also instrumental in helping folks with SVB just kind of exploding out of nowhere. One, you know, being a leader in the tech community, but two, being Pilot, being the accountant, the people are like, holy crap, what do we do here? So it's just like this in some ways good, some bright spots, but just like very uncertain times. A lot of folks in the audience are current founders or future founders. And I'm just curious, like, what insights or advice or like ways of thinking about things do you have to share with them?
I mean, this is not news. It's like a super, super tough fundraising market out there. And I think that is ultimately a good and healthy thing in the sense that it will force rigor and discipline among everyone in this room. And if it doesn't, well, then your companies will just stop existing. When we started our first company, it was June 2008. The financial crisis was a thing.
Wow.
I remember vividly we had email, you know, we like met a venture capitalist.
Whoa.
And we were like, cool.
Which one? Do you remember?
I think this Foundation Capital. This was okay. In Boston. And we like excitedly had the meeting, and then we like emailed them to follow up to see if they wanted to invest or whatever. And the guy wrote me back, and I'm paraphrasing, because again, this was like 20 years ago or something. He was like, look, normally we would just string you along with like a slow no and then eventually pass. But it's 2008, we're not writing any checks, we'll just tell you no. To which I was appreciative of. I was like, okay, that's cool, thanks. But it was like, we bootstrapped our first startup. And in doing that, I think it engendered like a super healthier respect for the value of the dollar. And if we wanted to spend money, we had to get more customers first. Like, it was that simple. There was not a magic source of funds that was unrelated to providing value for our customers. And it contorted us in some weird ways, but it caused us just to be laser focused on like, fine, how do we get more revenue? How do we get more customers? How do we build the thing that our customers really want? And I think that same energy is kind of like pervasive, like in the ethos of the moment. And I think that's super, super, super good and healthy because it keeps you honest. The problem with investor dollars is they're correlated with someone being interested in your thing, but they're not like the goal of the company. The goal of the company is to build a thing that people want and are willing to give you money for. And the way to validate that you've done that is to have people give you money for the thing that you've built. And everything else is just kind of like a proxy signal for that.
As I mentioned, you have a Substack, waseem.substack.com, which, by the way, incredible Substack. Probably one of my favorite, at least, titles is No One Cares. What is it? No One Cares That You're a Billion-Dollar Company.
Yeah, no one cares that you're a unicorn.
No one cares that you're a unicorn. Yeah. First of all, congrats on becoming a unicorn.
Thank
but
you.
Also,
thanks.
I think this is the same spirit that, like, get back to work.
Totally. I just think that fundraising doesn't matter. Because we talk about it so much, it has achieved this like interesting status in the mind of founders where they associate their success with how much money the company has raised. Fundraising is kind of bad. It's like a necessary evil. If you could build your giant billion-dollar company and you didn't have to raise any money, that even better. Again, the goal is not necessarily wealth creation, but if you look at like, why is Larry Ellison so rich? Why is Bill Gates so rich? Well, they didn't raise venture capital. And whatever, it was also a different time, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is like fundraising is a necessary evil. And you do it because you believe that taking on the dilution and taking on the capital and like giving up the ownership causes you to move faster and therefore unlock more value. Like we have raised a lot of money. Obviously, I believe that it was the right thing for us to do. But it's not winning, but it feels like it is, because like TechCrunch writes about you and then you speak on panels or whatever, but it's not the point. The point is you got to build the thing that people want. And I think it is a mistake. You should like, fine, pat yourself on the back, but then get back to work.
Awesome. All right, on that note, we'll open it up. Avery, where's Avery to have him ask his question? And I'll have Kay hand you the mic.
So if you were to do a startup today, what would you do for your fourth?
It's a good question. I tell people all the time that this is my final job. And like, maybe it's another 20 years. I don't know exactly what the parameters of that are going to be. But I think for us, I feel we have all the elements to make this the iconic enduring public company. And if we don't, then we won't. Now, I understand that that's not the question you asked. Your question was not, what will you do? It's like, what would one do? I'm not sure. I think one of the elements that is always necessary in my view is like a strong why now. Like for Pilot, the why now is sort of twofold. The why now is like, if you look at 2017 when we started Pilot versus like 2008 when we started our first company, there's a bunch of stuff that existed in 2017 that did not exist in 2008 as it relates to the financial back office, specifically like the cloud, but like Gusto and Stripe and Brex and Mercury and Expensify. They're just like, all of these things didn't exist, Plaid. You would have had to build all of those as building blocks to then be able to build Pilot. And so it was not possible to build Pilot in 2008, and it would have been a huge slog if you had tried. That's kind of piece one. Piece two was the change in consumer behavior, which is that, you know, in 2008, probably you want to go visit your accountant in their office downtown where they have like wood panels, whatever. That's what you wanted with your shoebox or receipts. And now you want to transact online. You don't want to have ever met me in person. We just like exchange email or we do a Zoom or whatever. So the second was a shift in consumer behavior from not just like tolerating the fact that your accountant might not live in your geography, but actually desiring that they're available remotely. So to sort of meta answer your question, I would look for a strong why now, which is what is possible today that wasn't possible previously? Because the idea itself is rarely the novel part. We're not the first people to think, like, what if you could do accounting for a lot of companies? Like, yeah, probably since like 14 whatever, like someone has been trying to do that. And the question is, okay, fine, it's uniquely possible now because of these technological or societal or whatever changes. So I would look for a why now, and I would look for like a big, 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 big market opportunity. I think in our first startup, we just like didn't really have a good intuitive sense for like what the size of a market might be and the importance of the market being large. So I think those are the two meta answer. Those are the two elements I would look for.
So you have been with your co-founders for a long time across multiple startups, and that's really impressive. And what are the secrets behind your guys' like longevity of relationships?
So I think it's a couple of things. One, I mean, it's a little bit self-reinforcing in a way, which is we've worked together for a long time, so we work well, so we continue to work together. I think it's like mutual trust and respect, of course. And then I think real clarity about areas of ownership. Like, Jeff, Jessica, and I do very different things at Pilot, and the things we do are largely non-overlapping. And that's by design. That's by design for two reasons. One is it enables speed, because we're not stepping on each other's toes. And it also enables speed because it doesn't require you to reach consensus on certain things. You can just go faster because it's like, look, that's clearly in Wasim's domain, let's just do it. Like, oh, this is clearly in Jeff's domain, he can just do it. And coupled with that, I think, is a strong, like a high-quality simulator of the other people's minds. Meaning, I feel like I could tell you for any given thing, this is what Jeff will say and this is what Jessica will say. Or maybe, you know, more granularly, this is a thing they're going to care about and want to talk about versus this is a thing that they are not going to have an opinion on or will be happy to defer to me on. And so for the stuff that, like, does either overlap distinct areas of ownership, like maybe it's a Wasim thing and a Jessica thing, and so obviously we need to talk about it, or a thing where I think they're going to have dissenting opinions, then we should talk about it, and we can have those discussions. And my perspective is like, if we disagree, they're smart people, there's probably something that is worth a closer look there, and so we chew on that. And then yes, ultimately I'm the CEO, if we have to make a decision, I will just make a decision. But I think there's like clarity about ownership and clarity about decision making, which allows folks to kind of go fast in their lanes and not feel like they're constantly butting heads with the other person. I think that does help a lot. Just like clarity about who is going to do what and how you're going to work together.
Hi, I'm also in the fintech space, so I'm very curious, do you think there will ever be a day where AI will fully replace accountants, or do you always think that there's going to be value for humans to look at generated reports in the end?
I mean, always is a long time, but I think in the comparatively near term, near to midterm, I think the job will continue to exist. I think it will just look very different than it looks now. One example of this is, you know, if you were an investment banker at Morgan Stanley or whatever in like the 1980s, one way that you might spend an afternoon is like you have a client and they're like trying to compare four different stocks, and you like go to the library and get a copy of the Wall Street Journal on microfiche, and then you plot out the share price for the stocks every month over the past year, and then you like make a nice chart, and then you like fax it to them. You're like, this is the trend of the share prices. And they're like, this is amazing. I'm so glad you spent 6 hours and however many hundreds of dollars doing this for me. Obviously, that's not what people do today, because that takes like 100 milliseconds for the computer to do. And yet the job still exists. It's just doing a very different thing. And so I suspect that probably what is the future of the accountant? No, it's probably not like reconciling the bank account or producing the P&L or whatever. Like, the computer will just do that. It's probably going to be like helping you think through questions you have about the business. It's going to feel more like the consultative member of your team and probably a lot less like the shape of the job today.
Sorry. Awesome. Thanks. Hey, Wasim, thanks for coming today and sharing. It's been really great. So my name's Dat. My question for you is, like, obviously you've had a really great journey with the other two, you know, co-founders from the start. Seems like you love each other. It's been a long journey. Are there any memorable, like, crises that you can think of, either serious or fun? And really, how did you handle it? Because I feel like there's some good stories in there.
Sure. At the first company, one of the things that was interesting is that everything, just like everything, seemed like urgent and like an emergency and like a company killing event. And I think one of the big differences between our experience at the first company and our experience at the second company was just the context and the experience to realize these are things that are truly important. And yes, you like stay up all night to do them. And no, these are just like normal things that happen in a business. And of course, you want to pursue them with urgency, but it's fine to do it tomorrow so that you can go home and have dinner with your friends or family, or, you know, sleep 8 hours a night or whatever it is. And what's interesting is, like, of all the stuff we worried about at the first company, it was basically like entirely not consequential. Like, I don't think any of the things that we had so much anxiety about really mattered. There was a time when a competitor launched a similarly named product and we thought it was the end of the world, and like that just wasn't relevant. There was stuff like that. We were just like very, very, I think we just didn't have a well-calibrated sense of what mattered and what didn't. I'm trying to think if there's anything. I mean, the competitor one is the one that definitely comes to mind, which is like, it's not even interesting. Like, I don't even want to tell you the story because it's like so boring. But it was like a huge deal for us at the time that someone had posted to the Linux kernel mailing list with a competing rebootless update project, but it wasn't as good as ours, but it seemed like the developers liked it more. It was just, it doesn't matter. But it didn't feel that way at the time. It felt like, oh my God, this is the end. And the other thing, and again, this is one of these things that maybe you don't say out loud or shouldn't say out loud, is like, I care deeply about our startup and our previous startups. And obviously I'm spending a lot of time and energy. The vast majority of my waking hours are devoted to making this thing successful. But it's not the only thing in your life. And I think it is hard to remember that as a founder, but I think it is important to remember that. Look, work super hard. Yes, like, go hard, focus on your startups. But like, you have other stuff going on. You should have other stuff going on. It is a marathon. It's not a sprint. You will burn. Like, one of the reasons we sold K-Splice to Oracle, we did it for about 3 years. But one of the reasons is because we were like super burnt out. Like, the offer came along. It was a good offer. It was the right decision. But also, we just like were super burnt out. And could we have generated more shareholder value slogging away at it for longer? Probably. But I think we just like emotionally just couldn't do it, because we were just so laser focused on it. But yeah, there was all kinds of horrible stuff that happened. Like, Red Hat was supposed to acquire the company, and like, it looked super promising. And then at the last minute, they discovered a patent that Microsoft had that was kind of maybe adjacent to stuff we were doing. We didn't think it was, but they did. And it was just like, they were like, JK, we're not going to give you a term sheet or whatever. And we're just like, fuck, did we just like waste 3 years of our life? No one's going to buy this company because of this patent. Is it over? There's just like all this stuff. And look, it matters, obviously, but I think you do need to keep the broader perspective around it.
Wasim, can you steal that briefly?
Sure.
All right, that's time. Wasim, thank you so much for talking to us about AI, but then also just sharing these pearls of wisdom about building a company, maintaining your sanity generally. I will also give my final shout out of the night to Wasim's Substack, not because he's paid me to do so, though it might seem like he has. Just honestly, very well written, to the point, quick reads about, I would say, at least half of the subjects that were talked about today. And that's not to say that these are like boring questions, but rather you've thought about the things that are on the minds of early stage founders. So giving a shout out to the Substack, and also just a huge round of applause for Wasim for joining us tonight. Thank you so much.